wait before the sunrise. And at 5 a.m. you get on the bus. The people look so resigned to the daily grind, and you swear it'll never be you. You said that you were new in town.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Intersections, presented by CITR's Intersectionality Collective. We're here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m., we host a panel of collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, sexuality, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
The city you live in is ugly.
And welcome to the first episode of Intersections for this season or this school year. I think I can speak for all of us when I say we're very excited to be back. And for our topic coming back, we decided to discuss violence against women in film, both within film and then also behind the scenes. So this is a pretty heavy topic. So there will be a lot of content warnings, including discussions of domestic violence, sexual abuse, and sexual harassment. But without further ado, I think we'll launch into our first topic, which is my own. This is Randy, by the way. So in thinking about what I want to talk about for this episode, I decided that I was really interested in this whole idea of like these male directors being upheld as like artistic inspiration and very just like, I don't know, like inspiring the next generation of film and having all these great ideas, but in reality, just being bullies and this, you know, culture of abuse that takes place behind the scenes, most predominantly against women. So in researching this, I came across a couple articles that discuss this about how we uphold these male directors for their, you know, artistic, I guess, like accomplishments. And then at the same time, upholding them, we're ignoring the abuse that they do behind the scenes. So yeah, I kind of connected this to this idea and this like archetype and trope we have of this like dark brooding bad boy artist type that we see a lot that like can be saved. And like, I don't know, this is kind of lame, but I always, I just thought of like, I'm forgetting his name now, but the guy from the movie After, who's like, I don't know if anybody's seen the movie After, but he's supposed to be this like bad boy, but he's like, he reads and he's like artistic, but he's abusive. Like that's, he's just truly an abusive guy. But moving on to a more serious note, this is a huge problem in Hollywood and then across like film industries in the West in general. So in these articles, I came across a couple of examples. And also these are often like very high profile male directors. So the two that I came across the most were Hitchcock and then Quentin Tarantino. So in the article it discusses Uma Thurman has alleged that Quentin Tarantino behind the scenes of both Kill Bill and Kill Bill 2, in one instance forced her to drive a car that was unsafe, which she then crashed and left her with lifelong injuries. And then Uma Thurman, in addition to Diane Kruger, both alleged that Tarantino choked them out with a chain during the filming of their respective movies. Once again, claiming that this was to get the most authentic and like realistic reaction out of these actors. And then as well, I think this is more of a famous example. Like I've heard of this before I went into this research, but in the movie, The Birds, which I don't know what year it came out, but it's quite old. It's a Hitchcock film. And the actress in that, Tippi Hedren, there's this scene where she's attacked by birds and Hitchcock chose to use live birds. And so there's evidence of him throwing these birds at her. So she was attacked and had like physical harm done to her on set for this movie, for this scene. And in addition to that, he also sexually harassed her numerous times behind the scenes on set. And actually, eventually, this is when she determined that she was going to leave the industry because it was too much to be in there. So yeah, I think just these examples are obviously very, this is a very limited number that I just came across in these two articles, which will also be linked in the episode description. So you can take a look at them and read them, which I really encourage you to do. But yeah, I think just kind of rounding out before we get to the questions, like these male directors are seen as artistic geniuses and they're praised by the film industries. Like they win Oscars, and their films are taught in film schools, right? And like a lot of people, even when they recognize the harm that's done by them, they'll be like, but look at the cinematography. Like the movie is so beautiful. The shots are so beautiful, which basically just like, you know, diminishes the experiences of these women. And then I just want to read this quote from this BuzzFeed article that I found. So, quote, "The line between provocateur and abuser remains very much blurred in the culture of film at large, and certainly in how we talk about directing movies. And producers, critics, and audiences have not just watched, but applauded over the decades as men who direct cross it over and over again." End quote. Yeah, so I kind of just, for discussing this, I just wanted to touch upon this, like what this means when we watch these films and like enjoy these as art. And so I kind of pose that, you know, when we watch these films that have these behind the scenes acts of violence, and in case like these acts of violence are filmed, right? And so those are the shots that end up being put in the movie. So it makes us voyeurs of violence. And so what does that say about our culture and our stance on violence against women in the creation of art and like for the creation of art? Yeah. So I'm very curious as like, if you've heard about this and kind of how you see this playing out, you know, in the film industry, but also connecting to like other parts of our life as well.
Yes. So when I heard about your topic, I was trying to think of modern examples of this and nothing really came to mind because I'm not someone who goes to the movies super frequently. So it's very possible that these examples exist, but I was trying to think of a very big popular movie where you see women as these passive recipients of violence. And I couldn't think of any where there was violence against women and they weren't a main character, and it wasn't a horror movie where the women were active and fighting against this. And even if maybe they died at the end, there was really this activeness to their character. And then I was thinking that the modern example of this that really comes to mind for me is true crime podcasts. And I think there's a lot with the idea of being voyeurs of violence, especially violence against women. We really see a lot of that has moved into true crime spaces. But what's interesting about that is that a lot of the people who are interested in listening to those podcasts are women. It's kind of almost a stereotype, and it's diminished that women find true crime podcasts interesting. And I was thinking about how there's this big gender divide because a lot of these classic movies, usually what you think of is like film bros and men who watch these movies to watch violence against women in a very harmful way. And then you think of true crime now, and it's a lot of women, and there definitely are some harms of listening to these. I think it's definitely, it can be very harmful to take on this messaging and to feel powerless and to feel unsafe in public spaces. But there's also a weird empowering element to true crime podcasts that a lot of people have mentioned, and that it's almost being aware of the harms that can be done to you to avoid them, or that it's kind of like the show Only Murders in the Building kind of does a subversion on this, where the main woman in the show listens to true crime podcasts, and then she uses that to inform herself about it. And then it really makes her, like, she acts out violently against people who try to hurt her. So I thought it was very interesting, this idea of voyeurs of violence, how who is participating in it can really change the character of what that voyeurism is, but also like how the art functions altogether.
Yeah, it is kind of like a double-edged sword in a way, because people's fixation on true crime on the one hand can like bring awareness to a certain topic when you're trying to highlight it with a film. But the thing about like you mentioned, trying to get actors, especially women, to do things that they're really uncomfortable with and also things that could be considered abuse. That's the big question. Like how the amount of suffering that it takes to produce art that fits the film culture and the part about reviews and the film bros culture. I think some part of it also is due to the fact that the film critic space has been dominated by men for a while now. And recently there might be more female critics, but yeah, it has something to do with like the space and like which people permeate it, which views permeate it, and like people trying to fit the mold of like what a good review, what constitutes like a good review in your movie, what kinds of things, what lengths you have to go.
Yeah, I think in addition to that, Adeline, like this idea of what is like an Oscar-worthy film, and like most of those are like very serious films and like honestly films that have themes about violence. And so I think there is like the question of like what, like is there actually a way to mitigate this? Because as long as we like uphold this value of like having an Oscar-worthy film or like containing these themes, like I feel like, you know, as that quote said in the article, like the line is always constantly going to be blurred. And unfortunately, I think because of women's position in the industry, they're going to be the most at risk to like be harmed by it. But yeah, I always just think of that because people will always be, you know, there's this idea that like, oh, if you watch like comedies or like romance movies, right, they're less serious and like they're less worthy of note. But like, I've heard a lot less cases of, you know, instances of abuse behind the scenes of films like that. Whereas like, I think, you know, when I was doing this research, a lot of these films that have these cases of abuse behind the scenes are films that went on to win Oscars. So I don't know, like, I think that's something that's, you know, we should be taking note of and thinking about.
And I think that also brings up these conversations of who is making the art to make it Oscar worthy. Cause I think the one modern example I can think of is Don't Worry, Darling. And I think it's a movie that's been made fun of a lot. Like that's the only context you see it in, is people making fun of it. And especially people talking about the two male leads and their relationship and things like that. But it actually was a good movie about the dehumanization of women and about abuse and kind of gender roles throughout different time periods. And not to get into it too much, people are going to see it, but it genuinely was a good statement on some of these topics. And it was created by a female director. It had some very talented female actors in it. And it feels like it was very undermined, and it probably won't get those Oscars and awards because all of the conversations about it are about how Harry Styles shouldn't have been in it, even though he was fine, or about kind of the silly things that have happened behind the scenes rather than recognizing that it's a good message. It's a good movie. It's a female director who I believe has done a lot of really good work throughout her career. So it kind of depends. It's when male actors do these sort of movies about violence against women, they're celebrated. And then a female actor does a movie about violence against women, and it's undermined continuously, not only in the film industry, but also just in our popular culture.
So to just go off of what Hal was saying, I think that people associate emotional depth in movies with victimization. And I think that also in society, we associate women with victimization. And so a seemingly logical jump between those is that, you know, Oscar-worthy, emotionally deep movies need to have some sort of victimization. And a logical conclusion is like people, like marginalized peoples or specifically women are victims. But that's just perpetuating this concept that women are inherently victimizable. It's kind of the whole damsel in distress kind of issue. And I just think that as like movies and like visual media becomes more and more prevalent in society, I think we really just need to examine how like it's perpetuating certain systemic issues and like ideals. And I think that like the victimization of women and like the damsel in distress concept are definitely being more and more, I don't know, pushed on you as a viewer. And I think that they always have. And I just see that with the movies that are winning Oscars, either the women were victimized and then they were able to like rise above it, or they're just consistently like pushed down. And I just think that's like a super unpalatable concept that we're being force fed, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. I agree, Serena. That brings us to the end of that topic. But yeah, we're going to go ahead. Serena, do you want to take us to the next topic to discuss?
It's alive. Mega Mall's debut EP, Escape from Lizard City, goes live on Friday, July 1st. Buy the cassette and lyric book on Bandcamp or stream wherever you listen to music. For the last 2.5 years, you could avoid everyone except yourself. Welcome to Lizard City. Oh, I see the love thinking over
time. Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess I'm just going to open with the concept of male gaze. I think that in film culture, as like a subculture, counterculture kind of thing, the concept of male gaze has been talked about a lot recently, and I think it's really important. And when I was thinking about male gaze, for people that aren't familiar, I guess it's just using the perspective of a typical heterosexual man when you're filming a movie. So it tends to objectify or sexualize women. And when I was thinking about the male gaze, I was also thinking about the Bechdel test, which is the test for female representation. And I realized that there is no test for harmful representation or violence. You have kind of a concept of like the male gaze and like the objectification of women, and then like having female representation like as like well thought out characters. But there's no test to see where the border of harmful representation is, where women are, you know, possibly it passes the Bechdel test, they're well represented, but they're only represented in harmful situations. So when I was thinking about that, I ended up looking into the American Academy of Pediatrics, and they are quoted from a study in 2001 for saying that, quote unquote, children are influenced by media. They learn by observing, imitating, and making behaviors their own. These movies that are always taken through a male perspective and an objectifying and sexualizing perspective of women, kids are actually growing up to practice these behaviors and see women in that way as well. They end up becoming the same writers and directors, and just it's like a vicious cycle. It just never stops because they see these things as kids and they normalize it to themselves, because it's not an inherently normal concept that women are sexual objects. That's not an actual normal concept, but we see it so often in media that we normalize it to ourselves. And then, you know, those same people grow up to become successful Oscar-worthy writers and directors, and then it just regurgitates. And I think that as media influence is increasing, we're just seeing the same things over and over. It's just really, really reinforcing these ideas. The other thing I was thinking of is what happens when the violence children are being influenced with is specifically men harming women. I was just thinking really about the question of like, what happens when little kids are seeing women consistently becoming victims and consistently being harmed, and men consistently being the ones to harm them? And I think that's impactful to both sides of that. I think if you're like a little boy, you're going to see people that maybe they're role models to you, you're going to see them just taking it out on their partners and like normalizing these abusive relationships. And then you might feel like either you're destined to do that and try to not break out of it, or that you have to like actively go against that. When I think that you can just really like the best rebellion against that is just by being a good person. I don't think it necessarily has to be such a giant thing. I think you just have to be respectful to your partners. And there's not enough media that just shows healthy relationships. I was even thinking about rom-coms, like specifically to me, The Notebook and Good Will Hunting. Those are both huge, huge, like successful rom-coms. People like really idolize the characters in those movies. But like, for example, in Good Will Hunting, I personally find Will to be super abusive and super manipulative to the love interest, and specifically violent anger. And I think that just goes back to boys growing up and seeing that all of these like super well-respected male characters, male love interests are physically and mentally abusive to their partners, and they get away with it. And it's seen as like this bad guy trope that you were talking about earlier. We need to see women and marginalized people in joyous roles, not just as victims. And I think that also with historical dramas becoming popular, it's another role in which women and other marginalized people are consistently just over and over seen as abused, victimized, and like oppressed. And, you know, they are true historically, but I think that once again, when we're talking about the male gaze, like who is making these depictions of history, really? Like there are other sides of history too, in which women were overcoming certain oppression that they faced, but we don't really see that. We only see the like big picture. I think that we just need to, you know, really think about what happens when it stays in your mind after. Cause like, I know that in class, we would get shown like a movie that would go along with the book we were reading. And then that image of what happens in the movie is what sticks with you, less so than the actual words or the text. So if you're seeing like visually these depictions of women graphically getting battered, that's what you remember more about history and more about the text than the actual possible like historical significance of those things. I also was looking at the TV rating system. So that's like the PG-13, like TV-MA, all those kinds of things. And I noticed that you can either include in a TV show, you can either include sex or violence, one scene of somewhat explicit sex or violence. And I think that it's really interesting to see that the movies geared towards younger people, like Marvel movies and Star Wars movies, always between those two, they choose violence. They don't choose sex. Like, I don't know how many Marvel movies you've seen where people even kiss versus like how many Marvel movies you've seen with people being super, super violent, getting like graphically tortured in some of them. And that's not necessarily specifically like violence against women, but I just think it's really interesting to point out that the media that we're showing young kids is geared towards violence and not even sex. I don't know, like between the two things that are graphic that you're not supposed to show kids, when given the option for a TV show to include one or the other, they almost always include violence. And I think that that's just, once again, like perpetuating this concept of like men are violent and women are victims. And I just was going to ask, how do you think this information affects us as people being educated in Vancouver, which is like known as Hollywood North? Like we go to a school that has a pretty rich film culture, and there's like many other film schools in Vancouver. So just how do you guys feel about hearing all this information when this is like a culture we're like pretty deeply entrenched in?
This is actually a conversation I had pretty recently. I was talking with some friends about whether it's better to have no representation at all or bad representation. And we talked about that in the context of queer identity and neurodivergent identity, both of which aren't very represented in movies and TV and are becoming increasingly represented. And now those conversations are becoming relevant. But in terms of the representation of women, this makes me think of something that's very common to talk about in sexuality research, which is called the good girl, bad girl dichotomy. And it's about how women fall into one of two categories, either good girl or bad girl. And that the first is kind of girl next door. And it has a lot to do with sexuality. She isn't sexually active. She's worthy, quote unquote, of being in a long-term relationship with, of introducing the parents. And then the idea of the bad girl in this dichotomy is that she's someone who doesn't have value as a woman. And it's almost always tied to being sexually active. And I think that that also is something that's very common in violence against women, is that especially in older movies, it's treated as a natural or justified response to women's sexuality. And that even And I think Gilmore Girls, there's a recent example that people were talking about, that there was one girl who was sexually active in high school, and then she didn't get into Harvard or whichever Ivy League school she wanted to get into, and her friend who wasn't sexually active did. And the way it was framed in the show was almost as a direct result. And I think we constantly see in films, even if it's not spelled out, that women are sexually active and then something horrible happens to them. And I think that is a lot of policing of women's sexuality is a big part of this violence against women in films.
Yeah, I mean, like, very quickly to build off your point, Hal, like, that's completely evident in the final girl trope of, like, horror movies, is like the women who are sexually active are killed off first, and then the virgin is the one who saves them. So that, like, archetype and trope. But I want to touch more upon, like, the rating system, because I've researched this before when I was a kid. And one thing that has always stuck with me is, like, you know, how you mentioned, Serena, like, you can choose one or the other, or, like, the way. So to me, that just represents how closely we link sex and violence in our heads. And especially in film, I think it's something that we don't tend to pay a lot of attention to. Like, I've been reading more and more ACE theorists, and they talk about, like, how ingrained sex is in our culture, in our society, and everything. But I think along with that, like, how close, like, how linked violence is, and then how we see them together. I think, like, to your point, like, how does this impact you as, like, you know, growing up in this city? And, like, I mean, they're filming on campus right now. I don't know what they're filming because they never tell us. But yeah, like, it is, like, I don't know, like, filming is so common in Vancouver. And, like, more so, obviously, if people live in LA, but I don't know, like, they film stuff in Alberta too. So, like, film is such, it's an interesting thing to think about because it's happening both in real life, but then it also exists in, like, a fantasy world, right? Like, these movies that we're seeing, we see them as fiction, but they're real people. It's a real set. Like, even if it's a set built inside of a stadium, it's still, it's a real chair. It's a real table. Like, I don't know. So I think that, not to get, like, too abstract, but I think that's something that I've been thinking about more recently is, like, how do we separate and think about these things as both existing in reality, but also as this, like, you know, fictional piece of artwork. I don't know if enough people can grasp that film is real. Like, it's not, even if it is fantasy and even if it is fiction, it still is having a real world impact. And I think we always need to be aware of what that real world impact is.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, like, back to the specifically, like, Marvel movies I was thinking of, they often hint at romance. You'll watch a lot of kids movies that'll hint at romance. Like, they'll, like, have a kiss on the cheek, or they'll, like, you know, hold hands or something like that. But the violence that they show is super, super graphic. No one hints at someone shooting a gun. Like, if you do that, it's seen as, like, super art house and, like, weird, like, indie movie. But, like, we see people being so graphically violent so often. But then, like, in kids movies, they, like, refuse to show what I'm going to call graphic love. Like, you never see graphic love, but you always see graphic violence. I just think it's really interesting that we almost never see graphic affection.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Okay, so Serena's topic did cover some of the points that I wanted to address with my topic. And so in general, I'm hoping to focus on the portrayal of female trauma to reflect historical events and or female empowerment. One of the films that I've been really looking into lately is the recent release of Blonde, which is supposed to be kind of like the idea of Marilyn Monroe's life, but it's not exactly like a minute depiction of her life. There are some fictionalized parts which are becoming like very controversial among audiences. It really kind of brings to light the extent to which films have creative license to portray people's lives, especially famous people's lives. And so when you look at Blonde and you look at the various like opinions that have surfaced on it, there is one opinion that I thought was very thought-provoking, which is model Emily Ratajkowski. She regards Blonde as fetishizing female pain and like how there's like a fixation on this when women experience this type of trauma. And like for a famous woman, especially even long after their death, we continue to like fixate on this. So really expanding on how the portrayal of female trauma in historical events, does that actually hinder the perception of women sometimes, even though the producers want to portray it as helping people to understand this kind of trauma? Another interesting point that Serena brought up was the damsel in distress stereotype, which is very prevalent in this film about Marilyn, since she had a very tragic life. I feel like there is a kind of oversimplification of this kind of female archetype sometimes, especially with people like Marilyn who have experienced like a lot of traumatic events and obstacles in their life. The huge controversy surrounding Blonde is that the film's been described as being a whole bunch of like trauma vignettes, just like a kind of combination of all the terrible things that have happened in her life. And there's less focus on the fact that she wanted to like seriously study as an actress. She was actually like a great comedian, but it seemed to focus more on like the objectification of her, and especially films where she was objectified a lot, such as The 7 Year Itch. When you're looking closely at the kind of like one-dimensional portrayal of women, such as the damsel in distress stereotype, there is a kind of permeation of this in society. Because like Randy mentioned, even though we are aware of the fictional aspect of film and like the various ways in which the producers try to portray things as being like a kind of fantasy and hoping that the audience will connect that with like the idea of a person, there's still a danger that if this like permeates a lot in society, can kind of seep into our unconscious. And like Serena was mentioning, the second danger is kind of like perpetrating the male gaze concept. There's also another interesting thing that I've noticed when it comes to this film. After Roger Ebert passed away, and Roger Ebert was like a very prominent film critic, very famous film critic in those circles, I noticed that when he reviewed a movie called The Accused in 1988, which was about a rape trial, I felt like there were some of these like sociological issues like surrounding women and objectification that he hadn't exactly addressed in his review. Whereas right now, like his review site after his passing, there's like other critics in a circle that would have to take over his column. And so for Blonde, there seemed to be like a female reviewer who reviewed Blonde. And so I felt like she did touch upon these kinds of issues in the review, just like the constant objectification of Marilyn. Like, even if the purpose is to like remind people, that was like some of the damage that was done by Hollywood, in the end, it just seems like overkill, you know, to the point where the viewer is really exhausted by all this portrayal of trauma and feel like it's very disrespectful to her memory. Some of those kind of questions that I hope to bring up is like, is there a kind of line that we have to draw in the sand when you're portraying these kinds of topics, like even for historical purposes?
Yeah, I think like bringing up Blonde, I haven't seen it and I'm not going to watch it because I don't think I feel comfortable watching it based on what I've read about it and heard about it. But as you were talking about it, I thought about the controversy that was around the miniseries Pam and Tommy, which talked about the relationship between Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee Jones and the release of their sex tape and what that did to their careers and like their, I guess, personhood. I can't think of a better word to describe it. I also have not watched that series because of what was talked about. So for example, Pamela Anderson had zero involvement in that series. To me, I think that raises a lot of questions because I think in the case of people like Pamela Anderson and Marilyn Monroe, they've become these like fictionalized real people. Like if we think about how often the image of Marilyn Monroe is used in the most random things, right? Like posters, there's a statue of Marilyn Monroe in front of like a diner on Broadway. I don't know. Like I ride past it on the bus every single day. And so her image just exists almost like in this space where like, we don't see her as a person, right? Like she has gone beyond, you know, what we consider ourselves as people and individuals to almost be owned by culture and by society. And I think Pamela Anderson has experienced the same thing. So I think, you know, when people set out to make these films and talk about their lives, I don't know if you can claim creative license and you can claim that you're doing something important because number one, you're profiting off of their trauma. Even if you say that you're trying to tell the real story, which is the case of like Pam and Tommy, the creator was, you know, I just quickly looked at an article where they said like, you know, they want to share the real story to show that Pamela Anderson is like more than, you know, just what we see her as, like the beautiful blonde from Baywatch. But yeah, I think to your question, like Adeline, like the idea of artistic license, I don't know if that applies because in my opinion, these women have been stripped of their personhood to the extent that I don't think that you as a, you know, male director can give that back to them by creating this film that profits and exploits their trauma.
Yeah, I think that raises the question of who has the right to tell these stories, because I think Marilyn Monroe, like you said, she's been so condensed down into this symbol. And I think she really has become culturally this symbol of what femininity is or should be. And I think she's even been, her image has been weaponized as this idea of femininity that people are expected to live up to. And I think this honestly could have been a fascinating film if handled by a woman who delved into who she really was and how those expectations are unreasonable and how her image has been weaponized. And then the fact that it was a man telling this story is the question of who has the right to tell this story. And while you're talking, I was also thinking about the show Queen's Gambit. And I think that one as well is a story about a very female experience. It's about a woman who was a chess player who is in this very male dominated field, I guess you could say. And I think it also was not handled well because I think, like I was saying in the last section, she was very sexualized. Her trauma was sexualized. She was this very beautiful pain put on display. And there wasn't enough attention given to the historical struggles that she was going through. And a lot of the trauma that she went through was just used to make her look pretty and this kind of vaguely European French like woman who's struggling. And I think if you compare that to movies like Little Women, where it is about female experience and is about traumatic experiences in their lives, but it's handled by a woman, I think that she tells this story in a very beautiful way that resonates with a lot of people. And it's a way that modern people can connect to historical events. And I think not to say that only certain people should tell stories about their own experiences, but I think when you're telling a story about an experience that's so unique to a certain community, and it's about the history that shaped modern day experiences, I think a lot of directors and creators do need to take that step back and say, is this my story to tell, or am I taking this story away from someone who may be able to handle it in a more impactful way?
Yeah, so I think all of that is very fascinating because I did watch The Queen's Gambit, and there were questions about how the time period where she was growing up in, some parts were not very realistic because, like, is it true that every man would accept her professional accomplishments just like that because she's successful? I mean, at that time, there was still a lot of sexism. So yeah, that's definitely another example about how these kind of views can like permeate and create a fantasy world where it's difficult to distinguish the issues that women face. So this brings me to my second question, which concerns the portrayal of a woman experiencing sexual violence. called The Accused, and it's a 1998 film starring Jodie Foster. So this is based on a true story, but it's not exactly a minute retelling of the story that it was based on. The characters are slightly different, but it's like the idea of that. So the story is basically about a woman. One night she goes into a bar to buy cigarettes. She ends up playing pinball with some of the people who were at the bar, and some music comes on the jukebox. So she also starts dancing. One of the men there starts dancing really close to her, and then eventually like he violates her sexually, and like a bunch of other men are like encouraging that, clapping and cheering, and like they also encourage at least two other men to like, take their turns with her. And so afterwards, there's the issue of prosecuting this. The main character, she kind of feels let down by her lawyer. The lawyer thought that if the character were to go on the stand, it would be disadvantageous to her due to her background. So she decides to make a plea bargain with the perpetrators instead. And that didn't sit well with Jodie's character. And so in the end, the lawyer kind of feels bad too about this, about how everything has turned out. She decides to try to prosecute the ones who encouraged the crime too. And you have to go through this trial where you have to like relive this trauma again. And it kind of shows Jodie's character, like, even if she knows that she has to get on there and she might be questioned about her lifestyle and everything, like she still wants to do that. And it is a jury trial, but in the end, there is the conviction of the people that encouraged the crime too. So that way, even if the people that actually violated her, like even if the plea bargain reduced their sentence to like 9 months, if the people that encouraged this crime are also convicted, then I think that lengthens the perpetrator's jail stay to like at least 5 years. After that, the main character feels like she did get some more justice from the situation. At the time that the film was made, there weren't exactly a lot of films focusing directly like on the subject, since it's like very sensitive and traumatic kind of thing to portray. This is one of like the first movies to do that. And obviously, like anytime you have this kind of portrayal, there is like a lot of controversy surrounding it. The actual scene where you see the violation, it occurs during the trial as a flashback. And so it does show the scene in full. That is the second question I have. Like, even for portrayals where you're highlighting different aspects of female empowerment from a traumatic situation, in order to fully understand what she was going through and like what she had to get through during the trial, everything about like her rage from the incident and like the different ways that's symbolized in the film, what is the extent to which producers should go in order to make people aware of this kind of topic in this context?
So this is actually something I've thought about, and this was one of the things that led me to wanting to talk about this topic on the show, but I actually disagree. I think that there are no instances where we need to showcase sexual violence on screen in film, because I think even if it is for like the reason of attempting to show the, you know, like horror of it and like to get people to truly understand how horrible, I think it's still extremely exploitative, and it also puts a burden on the actor to have to play that role. And I think this is, I always think of the movie Promising Young Woman. I don't know if either of you have seen it. It's a very interesting film. I encourage you to watch it. But like in that film, it's based around this, you know, the basis of the story is this act of sexual violence, and they never show it to you in the film. There's a scene where they show a character watching the video, and I believe you do hear some sounds from it, but it's never like, none of it is ever put on screen. You never see like any parts of it. And I think that by this point in our lives, we have the ability to imagine the violence. And I think also as part of empathy, like, you don't need to actually see it or like to, you know, to grasp like the true horror of it. I think like true empathy and like true understanding would just be, you know, being there with it and being like, I don't know that experience. I can't imagine that experience, but I support you and I believe you and I under, you know, and I'm here. So I don't know. This is something I think about a fair amount when I think about film and when I have watched film, because yeah, it is, there are a lot of people that will claim artistic license and like that idea that like, how are you going to like show the true horror to people? And my reaction is like, well, if you talk to most women, they could believe it. Like there is, I don't know. I think part of me is like, it's a bit disingenuous to like the viewer to be like, oh, you can't imagine this. But yeah, I think I'm starting to go a bit off of my thoughts, but I do think that's a very interesting point that you raise, Adeline, like, you know, and in this case of the film, cause I have heard about this film. Actually I've talked to my dad about it before, but yeah, I think it's a conversation at the very least that we need to keep having, because I think it's important that we communicate and like, you know, keep this discussion going. But from a personal standpoint, I am very much against showcasing these examples on screen.
Yeah, I don't have a particularly long or thought out response, but I think just the statistic that at this point, 1 in 3 women have faced some form of sexual violence or sexual harassment. This is something that it's very known what this looks like, how this functions. And I think there are people who don't understand what sexual violence looks like. It's not because they didn't have that opportunity to learn. It's because they aren't listening or have chosen not to listen, or it hasn't been made personal to them because no one who they know who has faced sexual violence has spoken about it. And I don't think it's that people don't have the opportunities to learn about it, but that at this point, I think it's a personal responsibility to listen to that, because it is so incredibly prevalent, especially in the United States and Canada.
Yeah, I think part of the issue that was surrounding the real story that the film was based on was that the trial was televised, and like afterwards people thought, okay, that wasn't a very good idea, because you're like exposing this person to like even more danger. So yeah, I guess we can transition to Howls now.
It's alive.
Megamall's debut EP, Escape from Lizard City, goes live on Friday, July 1st. Buy the cassette and lyric book on Bandcamp or stream wherever you listen to music. For the last 2.5 years, you could avoid everyone except yourself. Welcome to Lizard City.
Oh, I see the love thickin' over time.
Every Friday at noon, CITR takes you on a journey through Thunderbird Radioland. A journey of sound and song, of words and music, of the now and then, of the right here and the far away. It's the Eclectic Lunch, every Friday at 12 noon on Thunderbird Radio, 101.9 FM in beautiful Vancouver.
Okay, so for our last topic of the day, I wanted to talk about the Me Too movement. I kind of frame this as a way of moving forward from everything that we've talked about, possibly as a solution to some of the issues we've talked about, but also look at the drawbacks of this movement and kind of the work that still needs to be done. And I think the Me Too movement also is very prevalent in Hollywood, even though it is in a lot of spaces. So I think it's particularly relevant to this conversation. So for anyone who may not be familiar, Me Too was a hashtag campaign, primarily took place on Twitter and other social media. It was a response to sexual violence in all spaces, but it really gained prevalence once that conversation moved to Hollywood. So Me Too was an organization. It was called the Me Too movement. And it really started as a grassroots movement in the early 2000s, by a woman named Rhonda Burke. but it gained prominence in 2017. We're actually approaching the 5-year anniversary tomorrow at the time of recording. But in 2017, Alyssa Milano, who's a famous actress, tweeted the hashtag MeToo and used it as an open platform for women, particularly to share their experiences of sexual violence. And she wanted to emphasize the prevalence of this, particularly in Hollywood. And this really took off as a movement. And I think it was a very unique combination of kind of this showing the prevalence and also showing the depth of these experiences, because women had the option to either use the hashtag MeToo simply to show that they were there and stand in solidarity, or it really gave a platform for a lot of people to share their unique experiences and to talk about this and really shed some light on what sexual violence looks like. And this really led to some very high profile arrests or exposures. Harvey Weinstein was the most prevalent. I believe he is still in prison at this point. His trials lasted a very long time and were very public. Another major name was Bill Cosby, but his prison sentence has already ended. Like I said, this movement took place only 5 years ago and his sentence has already ended. And I think there's a conversation to be had about the fact that it was celebrities who popularized this, and that even though this movement existed for decades at this point, it really was Hollywood who popularized this movement, and that it was the role of women in positions of power, even if in Hollywood, as we've talked about, women are powerless in a lot of situations. They could use their name, they could use their standing, they could use even their social media following to kind of further this movement that became very prevalent throughout the United States and Canada, especially during this time period. But I also think it's noteworthy that a lot of the women who were at the forefront of this were white women, and that the original movement was created by a woman of color. And that it's also worth noting that the experiences of a woman of color who was not famous were somewhat undermined throughout the course of this movement. And though in the past couple years, there have been efforts to highlight Tarana Burke, her influence was largely undermined throughout a lot of this process. I think, however, a very positive element of this Me Too movement was it also highlighted the sexual violence against men in Hollywood. Terry Crews was the most prominent example who came out about his own sexual violence enacted against him. And I think this also opened a space for men to discuss this. And I think this was one of the first major platforms that we've seen in recent history where men could discuss their sexual violence. And I think that there's still a lot of work to be done in that space. I think that Terry Crews definitely was not accepted in the same way that a lot of other people were, but this was a very overarching movement that gave a lot of space to a lot of people. So noting the very positive impacts, noting some of the negative impacts about who wasn't included, what I wanted to discuss with you guys is how the Me Too movement could possibly be a roadmap for future activism, particularly activism against sexual violence. Was it a good campaign because of its presence on social media, because of its prevalence? Because, I mean, it was Times front page a couple times. It really had a large impact. Or were the drawbacks, such as even the commodification of this movement in certain ways, or the undermining of women of color, or sometimes the undermining of the experiences of men, are those drawbacks things that we can address in future activism?
So I did find that the 2019 documentary about Harvey Weinstein called Untouchable, it did mostly feature white women. I remember like Paz de la Herta was one of the few like women of color that I happen to remember from that. But yeah, that really goes into like a broader conversation of like how these movements kind of like travel, and if there should be like more of an effort to like highlight, you know, but when trauma is experienced, like, you know, there's a diverse spectrum where people like would experience this kind of trauma. And like, yes, men do like experience like this type of abuse too. And the overfixation on like female trauma and doing it like no favors in the portrayal, like in Hollywood, it doesn't help anyone. Cause like, not only does it like portray women as this one-dimensional like archetypes, like, that are like only that seem like they're only meant to suffer, you know what I mean? Like it doesn't highlight like men who experience abuse as well. And so another thing that I also found when it came to like women of color like speaking up about what they've experienced in terms of Me Too movement, there's like a well-known actress named Salma Hayek, and like while she was making a well-known film about a Mexican artist called Frida, she did experience like a lot of emotional abuse from Harvey Weinstein. He was trying to like get more physical with her, and like she was walking a fine line, you know, like it could have escalated into physical violence if it weren't for the influence of some other people that she knew. And so even after a lot of women shared their experiences through the Me Too movement, it took like a little while for her to like start describing like what she experienced, because according to her, like she'd always been like under the influence of like Harvey. Like he told her that like she was nobody. And so like this kind of like had a huge effect on her. And so, yeah, that's kind of like immediately what I thought of, like when you mentioned like how there could be more highlighting of the experiences of like women of color too.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. Like a lot of people lost, or I don't even think people lost it because it wasn't publicized to people that like this, you know, movement was created by a Black woman talking about the experiences of, I believe, young Black girls. So like a very specific experience that was then to an extent taken by like privileged white women in Hollywood. And I think it sort of shifted, but I wanted to touch more upon like this general idea of like social media campaigns to create change. I think, and like, I'm going to start off by saying I'm very underqualified to talk about this. I'm not like, you know, a social media activist, so I'm not going to pretend that I'm an expert in this, but just from what I've seen, I think that it's very important to realize the difference between the internet and reality. I think a lot of times when we see content online and when we see like movements and all of this, you know, stuff happening online, it's not necessarily always grounded in reality. And I don't say that to diminish the work that is done online, because it's very important. I think we've seen, you know, like what talking about and like publicizing the story of what's going on in Iran right now is very important. And social media is playing a ginormous role in that. And I think, you know, as well as Me Too, right? Like social media has the power to spread these stories way further than, you know, other traditional forms of media. And it also is more able to center the person with the experience, or what we might consider in society as the victim. So I think those are very important. But yeah, I think just like sometimes conversations get away from us online. And I think Me Too was sort of this, you know, it started out as one thing. And I think now 5 years on, I can think of numerous times where it's now a joke. A lot of shows, you know, will write in a joke about like a guy getting Me Too'd, or like, you know, like, oh, that guy's not in the industry, he got Me Too'd. So I think to an extent, it's just not taken seriously with it, which I think is very, very sad. Because yeah, this stuff is important and it needs to be talked about. And I think social media provides a very good platform for us to discuss these topics.
Yeah, and I think the fact is on social media was both the pro and the con of the movement, because I think the fact that it was a semi-anonymous platform was really beneficial for a lot of people who are sharing their experiences, because they had the benefits of anonymity, they could feel more safe. They didn't have to have these conversations with people they knew if they didn't want to. They didn't have to feel like their livelihoods were in jeopardy. So it had a lot of benefits that there was this anonymity, but it also had a lot of drawbacks, because then the response to it is also anonymous. And one thing I noticed is I think that the Me Too movement, the response to it was then the conversation about cancel culture. And I think now these two things are almost considered to exist in opposition, and that Me Too is therefore considered cancel culture, and that men who are held accountable for their actions are being canceled. And I think that, unfortunately, and no fault of anyone involved in the movement, I think that this movement resulted in a lot of the conversations we have now about cancel culture, and that any form of accountability is the same as being treated unfairly online, and that all things online are therefore unfair. And I think that that's one drawback of these online platforms, is that even if you have the benefit of anonymity, so do the people who are enacting this harm.
Yeah, I I really like that you said that. As soon as you made the connection between like how Me Too has been taken and like created this link between cancel culture and then the conversations that we have about cancel culture, I feel like a broken record when I say this, because in my head it's not a new idea, but the internet lacks all of the nuance. There is like zero nuance on the internet. And I think these conversations, like, it's so different, you know, us having this show, the things that we talk about on this show, you know, none of us are experts. Like, we all have, I think, education, you know, some of us have graduated university, we're in university, we're in the liberal arts program. So like, you know, to an extent, we're educating ourselves in these topics. And I think we also educate ourselves outside of school as well. But, you know, I don't think any of us are going to lay claim to being experts on gender, race, sexuality, anything like social justice. But I think it's interesting how like I look forward to having these conversations, you know, and I think it's fun. And also a great experience for us to learn, you know, when we interview people. However, like the thought of having these conversations on Twitter makes me want to break out in hives, because, you know, even when I have tweeted things, I will rewrite it and write it and rewrite it. And it never feels like, because, you know, you do have this gap of like, you don't have the tone, you know, you're typing a littlest message. And even if you type a thread, most people only read the first message or the first tweet in thread. So I really truly respect people who discuss these topics and like are involved in social justice campaigns online, because it is such a complicated platform to have these conversations. And I think that's why I always encourage people to like, yeah, be on Twitter, be on the internet, but then get off of it and go to your friends, go to your like colleagues and have these conversations with a person face to face. Because I think it's just, yeah, as much as, yeah, I just, the word nuance is just so, I feel just like so redundant saying it again, but yeah, that's just when you said that, it just immediately made me think of that.
Yeah, and I think so many of these issues aren't even inherently an issue with Twitter, for example, itself. And I think definitely the platform has some issues based on who owns it and how it commodifies things. But just the nature of the platform is that it's short messages and you really can't get into that nuance. And I think that that isn't inherently a bad thing. It's our relationship with Twitter and other social media that's so bad, because we treat a lot of things as expert opinions when they maybe aren't. And we treat this kind of very short form media as the end all be all, when you really do need that longer media to delve into this. And it's also, social media is unique in that it is possible to put it away. And if you see something that you don't like or see something that's holding accountable, there are impacts of that. Like, there are very real impacts of that. But at the end of the day, it is possible to just set your phone down. And a lot of people who are in positions of power, they can do that. And then often go back to their kind of lives outside of the internet. And I think that's why, like you said, so many of these conversations are really important to have with friends and colleagues, but also important to have community activism in the real world and picket signs and things along those lines, because they're a lot harder to ignore. And social media, even though it does have a large presence in our lives, I think it's just a facet of the larger organization. And it's important to look at all components of that, especially kind of in the real world.
Yeah, I think the conversation about the internet is something that we really should like critically examine nowadays, because when it comes to the Me Too movement, right, on the one hand, you have like men starting to like get offended and like actually disregard these issues because they think that it's a kind of cancel culture and like people can just be canceled for whatever. And then on the other hand, you have the danger of like, if a lot of famous people in the industry actually defend someone who is accused of sexual misconduct, like that might influence people's perceptions too. And like, sometimes people can't really be sure, is it because they're a critically acclaimed filmmaker in the industry and like people are defending them like more for their influence or something else. And that kind of goes back to what Randy was discussing about how like there's some like really well-known people in the industry, they're seen by geniuses and like people don't think they deserve a certain type of treatment after they're accused. It just opens up like another whole can of worms, like if things are done like directly on the internet. And that reminded me of like the case around like Roman Polanski. There were some celebs that said they originally signed the petition supporting him because someone that they respect gave the petition to them, and then they just signed it thinking it was a valid cause. And then afterwards they kind of realized I just kind of went along with the wave, and then they apologized. But there were like a lot of other prominent people in the industry, like you didn't really hear a peep from them afterwards. So that kind of like brought up the question of like someone's like influence within the industry and how that affects these things. And like that goes into society too. Like if someone's like really accomplished, like reminding me of like this Stanford University rape trial, where like the guy apparently was like a very accomplished athlete, and like, but like, should we like overlook these things just because prosecuting him fully would like disrupt his life, you know? Like there were a lot of questions about that. Like the defense would certainly bring something up like that during a trial, and you'd see that in like a film such as The Accused. Especially if a person is young and seemingly accomplished. Yeah.
So just to wrap up this last section, I think that the Me Too movement can be a response to a lot of the ideas of sexual violence that we've talked about in the previous sections. And I think it absolutely is imperfect, but it is a good step. And I think just the fact that things were publicized more, I think this drastically change the culture that we live in. And I think it's easy to take that for granted because it was 5 years ago and we've gotten somewhat used to it. But I think this culture of accountability for people in positions of power, it's still having implications today. And I think it definitely is opening up those conversations. And yet at the same time, I think it's important to acknowledge the flaws in this movement. And that even if the general purpose is good, some of the logistics of it and the actual way it was enacted had some harms. And I think that just brings back the importance of intersectionality and making sure we're recognizing whose voices are reprivileging, who really is giving the opportunity to speak in these spaces. Are we recognizing who's responsible for this work that's being done? And I think that this was a great kind of crash course in learning how to do social media activism, and that some of those lessons can move forward into other forms of activism in the future, and that we can just continually improve on this and make sure that we're continuing to communicate about these issues that affect a lot of people in a way that equally privileges everyone's voices.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to end this episode off on. So thank you, Hal. I want to thank you for listening. This episode is definitely dealing with, I think, heavier topics than we've touched upon in the past. But I do think these conversations about like violence, in film, behind the scenes of film, and just in general in the film industry are incredibly important, because I think most of us watch movies, television shows on basically a daily basis. I want to thank you again for listening. We hope that you listen to our follow-up episode on this as well, where we'll talk to some other people about more of these topics.
Thanks for listening to Intersections by CITR's Intersectionality Collective on 101.9 FM. We would love to be reached by email at intersectionalitycollective@citr.ca or on Instagram at intersectionality_CITR. Send us your comments, feedback, and episode ideas. You can also find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program, and our theme song is provided by Young and Sexy. Tune in on Tuesday at 10 a.m., 2 weeks from now, for the next episode.